As commented on by Dr. Langer, one of the most exciting new data sets in lung cancer research is the fascinating work with patients who have tumors with EML4 ALK translocations, and I met with one of the key figures in this historic effort, Dr. Alice Shaw, who began our conversation by commenting on the background of the work.
Let's take a trip back in history a little bit and talk about EGFR. We know about 5-6 years ago, it was discovered that we had seen some dramatic responses to Iressa, were probably due to these activating mutations in EGFR. So that kind of set a paradigm for thinking about lung cancer as potentially different subsets of disease that are defined by specific genetic mutations. But what we also knew about EGFR mutations is that they don't occur very frequently. In our population of patients in this country, we see EGFR mutations in about 10% of patients, and they tend to be the never smokers. There are obviously many never smokers who don't have EGFR mutations. And so clearly, all along, there's been an interest by many people, including myself, to look for other mutations and understand what might be other subsets of lung cancer. So about 2.5 years ago, Dr. Hiro Mano, who works in Tokyo, actually reported in kind of a landmark paper in Nature the discovery of a new oncogene in non-small cell lung cancer. This oncogene actually is an oncogenic fusion, which means it's basically a fusion of one protein called ALK, or anaplastic lymphoma kinase, to another gene called EML4, which stands for echinoderm microtubule-associated-like protein. And what happens when this fusion occurs is that ALK, anaplastic lymphoma kinase, all of a sudden becomes activated. Actually, it's expressed and activated where it normally shouldn't be expressed or activated, and this drives the formation of a cancer. And this was a very exciting discovery, in part because ALK, being a kinase, is a logical target, and also we already had ALK inhibitors in trials, just beginning in trials. So this was about 2.5 years ago, and once we learned about the discovery of this mutation, our molecular pathology group led by Dr. John Iafredi started developing assays to screen for this ALK fusion. The way we actually screen for it is using a FISH assay to look for this rearrangement that places EML4 right next to ALK. So he actually piloted and optimized that assay, and within about 3 months from the discovery or reporting of EML4 ALK, we started screening patients. And when we started screening patients, we didn't quite know who to screen. So we initially focused on patients who we thought might have EGFR. So they tended to be the never smokers, patients with adenocarcinoma. And actually the first case, the reason I chose the first case for you is because this was the very first patient we identified with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer harboring EML4 ALK, who then went on to a phase 1 trial of an ALK inhibitor, PF234-1066. And the primary oncologist was Dr. Tom Lynch, but I actually did follow him intermittently at the time as well, and that's actually what got me interested in this field, seeing how this patient did.
I think Tom actually told me about this patient. Is this the patient who was like super sick?
Yes, very, very sick, and he had this miraculous turnaround. And, you know, it was almost like some of the patients that Tom and others had treated back in the Iressa days, except that back then they didn't know it was EGFR mutations that were the reason for this response. Here we actually knew this patient had ALK and was now going on an ALK-targeted therapy and was having this amazing response. So it was confirming what we thought would be the case, that ALK might confer oncogene addiction to these patients' tumors, but that was purely based on preclinical studies and sort of biology. And he was the first example now demonstrating that in the clinic, this is true.
This is a 48-year-old man.
Yes.
And he was a non-smoker?
Never smoker. He's a physician.
Wow. And I assume his tumor was EGFR wild type.
He was wild type for EGFR. He was actually tested at the time of diagnosis for this patient. It was back in the spring of 07. We were already screening patients up front for EGFR mutation. So he was screened right away given his non-smoking status, and he was found to be wild type or to have no EGFR mutations.
And when he presented, what kind of condition was he in?
You know, he was symptomatic. He also had a pleural effusion at that time, so he was coughing and short of breath, but he was good performance status of zero.
His disease was in the chest or outside?
It was primarily in the chest and also in the neck.
And so I see in your case history that he got cisgem initially.
Yes.
And then he got erlotinib.
Yes.
And progressed on that, and that was around the time you tested him?
Yes, that's exactly right, in the fall of 07.
So was he up on the web and trying to understand what was going on, or more sort of turning it over to Tom?
No, he was incredibly well-informed, you know, with his MD background. He was a very smart man, was very much doing literature searches, finding new, potentially new avenues for us. And, you know, it was just coincidental that we had started screening for ALK. And so, of course, we screened him.
And just to backtrack a little bit more, so at the time he went on the study, what was his condition?
So he went through the SysGem that we mentioned, and then we started him on Tarceva despite knowing that he had no activating EGFR mutations. And during that time of being on Tarceva, he progressed significantly to the point where he was so symptomatic, he was on high flow oxygen and basically confined to a wheelchair. He was so sick.
And this was mainly because of pleural effusion or also parenchymal lung disease?
No, a lot of parenchymal disease.
Wow. What was his family situation?
Married, had a very wonderful, supportive wife and children as well.
And so he was, sounds like, very kind of desperate straits there.
He was.
And just, again, a couple more points before you go on. Just to clarify a little bit about what this fusion is, how does this intersect with what was seen in lymphoma, the actual ALK fusion of lymphoma?
Right. So now we know that ALK can occur as different fusions in different cancers. So ALK was initially discovered as a transforming oncogene in the context of anaplastic lymphoma, and there it actually occurs as a number of different fusions, the primary one being NPM or nucleophosmin ALK. That's the fusion that occurs in anaplastic lymphoma. We also know that ALK can occur as different fusions in other cancers such as inflammatory myofibroblastic tumor. And the fusion that we predominantly see in non-small cell lung cancer is a fusion with this protein EML4.
And prior to this in lung cancer, had any therapeutics been developed for lymphoma and these other tumors?
So yes, there was definitely interest in developing ALK inhibitors. The issue, though, at the time when these inhibitors were being developed, there wasn't felt to be a great demand for these inhibitors because at the time we only knew about ALK translocations and fusions occurring in lymphoma. And in anaplastic large cell lymphoma, actually those patients who have ALK translocations do pretty well and can be cured with chemotherapy. And so I think the concern from a pharmaceutical standpoint was that there wouldn't be a great need for these. There was even one ALK inhibitor, very good, we use it in the lab, that the development was halted because it was felt that there wouldn't be enough need.
Now, this agent that he ended up being treated with, the MET-ALK inhibitor, PF02341066, does it have a better name yet, incidentally?
Not yet. We're working on it.
What do you call it around there, incidentally?
We do call it 1066.
1066. Okay, that's not too bad. So where did that come from?
So that's very interesting. So that actually was initially developed as a MET inhibitor. So it actually is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor that targets the MET tyrosine kinase. And on screening, they also found that it targeted ALK as well.
And remind me where MET is?
So MET is a receptor tyrosine kinase. It's activated and can be amplified in a number of different cancers. In the lung cancer world, what we know about MET the most is that MET amplification is one mechanism by which EGFR mutant lung cancers can become resistant.
So is that tied into, what is it, T790?
Yes.
Is that the same
exactly
thing,
right?
Sort of?
No, it's a different mechanism. So in the setting of EGFR mutation, we know that when patients become resistant, about 50% of them have acquired this T790M mutation within EGFR. But another 20% of them actually have acquired amplification of the MET locus.
Right. Now I remember this graphic Tom showed at the ISLAC meeting, and you see the MET on the side there. Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. This is not your, what do they say, not your father's lung cancer anymore when you're trying to figure out which chemo gives you another 3% or whatever, huh? Some serious biology going on here.
Yes, there is.
So this agent, though, was out there, and when it was developed, what were they thinking they were going to do with it?
Well, it was initially obviously put into a phase 1 trial to look for safety and toxicities, and they were ultimately hoping to target patients with MET amplified tumors. We see that in the setting of esophageal cancers, and some very small percentage of lung cancers have MET amplification. So the initial protocol was actually designed to include sort of the standard dose escalation phase, and then the second part would be a dose expansion phase that included MET amplified patients.
So was the phase 1 trial already up and running, and the agent was discovered when it was discovered that lung cancer patients had this fusion?
Yep, the trial had already been around for about 1 year when we discovered the EML4-1. Dr. Mano discovered the EML4-ALK fusion. So we were very lucky that way in that this agent had already gone through about a year's worth of testing.
And just out of curiosity, how was it doing in the other tumors?
Well, you know, it was still in the dose escalation part. So this particular patient actually as well enrolled in the dose escalation part, and I think he was the first one to really have a dramatic response.
And this is oral, correct?
This is a pill, yep.
And what exactly happened once the man started on treatment?
So when this patient started on treatment, the way it was set up was that he received a dose on day -7, so just one dose. And then a week later, he started taking the medicine twice a day. And he actually reported to Dr. Lynch that he started feeling, well, he says he actually felt better even after that first dose. Mm. But really, in terms of when he turned around, it was within a week or two, which is actually very characteristic of how these patients with oncogene-addicted tumors behave when they finally receive a targeted therapy.
And when did you first do an objective assessment on him?
I think at his first office visit was probably 2 weeks after he started on, actually, we were seeing them weekly. So I can't recall if it was at the very first week or at the second week after he had been on the medication, but already, I think he was off of oxygen. He was not in a wheelchair anymore. He was feeling great.
What was seen when he was imaged?
So he had a nice response in his lung. He still had a fair amount of disease and he also had fluid, but he definitely had a nice response. By tumor metrics, he didn't quite make PR. He didn't quite make 30% reduction, but I would say that his quantitation of his lung tumor burden was complicated because he had so much. But there was a very, when we looked at it, it's a very dramatic response. And certainly clinically, he looked fabulous.
Now, this was Tom's patient. Are you the PI on the study or how did you get involved with it?
Well, I was interested in ALK as an oncogene, and I was working with the molecular pathology group, Dr. Iafredi, to establish the infrastructure so that we could screen more patients for this. And certainly, I think this patient's experience on this trial, you know, is very motivating to continue screening and expand screening to other patients.
Now, how did he tolerate therapy and how do people in general tolerate it?
Yeah, so let's talk about him first. I mean, like I said, he initially responded incredibly well. I mean, his breathing, his oxygenation was incredibly improved compared to starting. He tolerated the medication well in the sense that he felt well. He didn't have very significant side effects. I'll talk about those in a minute. The main problem for this patient, though, was hepatotoxicity. And we have seen this in anywhere from 5 to maybe 8% of our patients that they develop transaminitis. And he did develop a grade 3 transaminitis that required us to hold the medication. And unfortunately for him, when we went back, his LFTs recovered. But then when we rechallenged him again, even at a lower dose, his LFTs rose again. And so eventually he actually just couldn't tolerate the medication and we had to take him off study.
How long was he actually on treatment?
He was on treatment for, I think, close to 3 months.
And then what happened?
Well, then, unfortunately, once he came off, he actually started progressing again, and he was tried on another line of therapy. It was Sutent, actually, and he didn't respond, and then he passed away.
What's been seen in general, and we'll talk about the efficacy, but what other problems have you seen with the agent?
Sure. The transaminitis is probably the most serious consequence that I've seen with this study medicine. Like I said, it occurs in about 5 to 8% of patients. It tends to occur at a very specific time from when they start therapy. It's right around 3 to 4 weeks after receiving continuous 1066. And the LFTs have gone as high as, you know, grade 4 in one patient out of now 70 and grade 3 in 4 others. So we definitely do see it. We watch very closely right around the week 3, week 4 mark. Once patients pass that mark, we actually haven't seen any transaminitis after that. Other side effects of the medication actually are mild. They're almost all just grade 1. Grade 1 nausea and vomiting, grade 1 diarrhea, grade 1 fatigue. There can be a visual disturbance that's described by many patients as seeing a shadow or trail with objects, especially when they move from dark to light setting. We've had these patients undergo ophthalmologic exams, and there's nothing wrong with their eyes, actually. And this is just a side effect that can be seen with this drug as well as a variety of other drugs.
Just out of curiosity, what do the ophthalmologists say? Is it a retinal toxicity? Or
no, there's no pathology.
So what's going on? Why do they have it?
We don't know. Hmm. We see it with other medicines, and there's no pathology to explain the changes that are seen in the vision.
Now, this agent, it's not a TKI, is it?
It is a TKI.
Okay, it's a TKI. And any other sort of TKI type thing, skin, for example?
No, so no rash. The other, I guess, TKI-like side effect would be diarrhea. It tends to be mild. It can occur as soon as patients take their very first dose of 1066. In general, it tends to be fairly mild and also episodic.
So this man had a short little reprieve for, I guess, a few months?
He did.
Just before we get back into the science, what did that mean to him?
I think it was incredible. He really was so sick, and it was right around the holiday time of 2007, and he was very sick. And I think most of us who actually saw him at that time, including Dr. Lynch, and some of us in the group who were covering during the holidays, were concerned that he wasn't going to make it through the holidays. But that's right when we started the drug. And then the next time we saw him, you know, he just looked amazingly better.
And any experiences that he had in those few months that were meaningful to him that you knew about? A lot of people talk about, you know, sort of looking forward to things that mean a lot to them.
Well, I just remember one time when Dr. Lynch and I were talking about him and how amazing he was doing. And to illustrate how amazing he was doing, Dr. Lynch told me that he and his sons were planning a ski trip.
Wow.
Which is pretty amazing considering where he, you know, just 2 months prior was in a wheelchair.
So let's see. I didn't mean to interrupt your story, but, you know, that's just, you know, kind of the way it goes. Maybe you can kind of fast forward to when you gathered enough data that you wanted to present it. I mean, I know you presented it at ASCA, but was that the first time you actually had it all together and presented it?
So there's two different ASCO presentations that you may be referring to. One was actually the first update of the safety, toxicity, and efficacy of 1066 in patients. That was presented for the very first time by Dr. Eunice Kwok at ASCO 2009. And at that same ASCO meeting, I actually presented data from our group reporting on the clinical pathologic characteristics of patients who harbor this ALK translocation.
And maybe you can go through that. I guess in a way, there was a lot of overlap in terms of the kind of patients who get EGFR mutations.
That's exactly right. There is a lot of overlap. They share certain demographic features, in particular being a NUVR or a light smoker. They also, almost all, are adenocarcinoma histology. And there is, you know, EGFR mutation clearly is enriched in Asian populations. There probably is a slight enrichment of ALK translocations in Asians, although not as significant as EGFR mutation.
Now, at this point, have you looked at enough other populations to get some kind of feel for what the total, let's say, percent of all non-small cell this is and the percent of non-smokers?
Yes, so we have. We, in our study, as well as looking at quite a few studies that have been published from other countries, overall, the frequency of ALK in non-small cell lung cancer is on the lower side. It's roughly 3 to 4% of all patients. What we did is we actually looked at the population at MGH, and we looked at patients who were never smokers or light smokers. And in that group of patients, we actually see that the frequency of ALK translocations is higher, roughly 10%, maybe 15%. And then you can enrich further if you isolate patients who are never or light smokers, and we know they do not harbor EGFR mutations. In that subset of patients, we see ALK translocations in about 30% of those patients.
Just out of curiosity, what number would you give in terms of the fraction of non-small cell and maybe the fraction of adenocarcinoma non-small cell that are non-smokers or oligosmokers in a minimal smoking history? What numbers would you come up with for that?
I think overall, the numbers show that about 15% of all non-small cell lung cancer patients are never or light smokers, about 15%.
And how often do you see, frankly, either EGFR mutations or this EML-ALK translocation, how often do you see it in patients who have something other than adenocarcinoma?
So that's a good question, actually, because in the initial report from Dr. Mano's group back in 2007, he reported that he actually first isolated the EML4-ALK fusion oncogene from a tumor from a patient who had a smoking history. And also when he went to look at other patients from his study, there were one or maybe two that had squamous histology. So we were actually thinking, oh, maybe perhaps this is one of those rare mutations that we're actually going to find outside of adenocarcinoma or together with adenocarcinoma. But when we've actually looked at our data set, I think every single patient except for one that we've identified as ALK positive actually has had adenocarcinoma.
So it's kind of a similar story to the EGFR mutations.
It is, very much so.
So what about efficacy? You had one of the all-time waterfall plots. Actually,
yeah.
It was yours and also Keith Flaherty in melanoma on the
yes.
other side of the street. Those are my two favorite graphs of ASCO 2009. Can you talk
yes.
about what was reported?
Sure. So we can talk about what was reported at ASCO. We also then presented an update at World Lung. And then most recently at AACR, just this past week, we presented yet again, Dr. Kamage presented yet again, the most up-to-date results on efficacy. Do you want to hear about the most up-to-date ones?
Maybe you can talk about what was reported at ASCO and then what this most recent report was.
Sure. So at ASCO, Dr. Kwok, Eunice Kwok, presented both the safety and toxicity of 1066 along with the efficacy that was seen at that time. And I should tell you that waterfall plot was beautiful, but it's so much smaller than it is now in terms of the number of patients that have been treated. So at that time, which was May of 2009, there was a response rate of close to 60% and the disease control rate, which is equivalent to the number of complete responses, partial responses, and stable disease patients of about 80% or so. But the majority of patients, therefore, were either responding or having stable disease.
And how many patients was it?
At that time, I think she only reported on about 20.
And what I recall, when the waterfall plot, it seemed like everybody went down at least a little bit.
Yeah. You know, there have been, and we'll talk about this, there have been a handful of patients who actually did not respond to 1066 despite having the ALK translocation. But in general, the majority of patients, and I would say the vast majority of patients, have stable disease or a response.
And maybe you can talk about the more recent update, but has there been enough experience to see sort of what the duration of response is?
That's a good question. So at the most recent update that Dr. Kamage gave at AACR in San Diego, on the phase one trial now, we've enrolled over 70 patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer harboring ALK translocation. And the response rate now is close to 70%. And the disease control rate is close to 90%.
And do you have people who now are kind of progressing?
Yes. So actually, in our second case, we'll talk about a patient who's doing well, going on now 15 months. The median duration of treatment to date has been probably close to 27, 28 weeks. But most of the patients who have achieved a PR are actually still on trial and doing well.
Why don't we talk about this second woman, as long as you brought her up? This 50-year-old. How did she present?
So this is a 50-year-old woman, also a never smoker, who otherwise was very healthy, and she developed symptoms of a pneumonia. She was coughing a lot, but she also had hemoptysis. And she was initially seen by her primary care physician, who prescribed antibiotics, and she didn't improve, kind of a common situation here. And I think the suspicion for a lung cancer at that time was very low, given her non-smoking status. So eventually, though, she did undergo imaging studies, which actually did show a mass, and she was diagnosed with a stage 1B non-small cell lung cancer, adenocarcinoma with BAC features, and she underwent a lobectomy. And now this was back in 2005, actually, so close to almost 5 years ago.
At any point, did she have an EGFR mutation?
She did not at that time. When she was diagnosed, it was 2005, and I think we were just getting around to EGFR mutation testing, and she was also resectable at stage 1B. So she just underwent resection, and she then underwent adjuvant chemotherapy.
I don't know if you know, the first time I ever interviewed Tom was 2 weeks before the New England Journal paper came out about the mutation in 2004.
Is that right?
And it was embargoed. So I just kind of said, you know, anything new in terms of predicting response? And his face got all red. And I said, what's going on here? And he said, I can't tell you. And I'm like, okay, you're going to tell me soon. And, you know, 2 weeks later, he was on Good Morning America or something.
That's very funny.
Yeah, it is. Anyhow, so she didn't get mutation testing, but she got erlotinib when she progressed.
Yes, at the time of progression, she did receive erlotinib.
And at what point did people start thinking about EMLAC testing in her?
So we actually, after she completed her lobectomy and was in the midst of her adjuvant chemo, she did get EGFR mutation testing at that time, and she was negative. You know, since we have seen some responses in some of our wild-type EGFR patients, I think it was reasonable to put her on Tarceva as a trial, but she didn't respond, and actually her symptoms progressed, and at that point, she underwent testing for the ALK translocation.
What was her clinical status at that point?
She was still a very good performance status. Like I said, she's otherwise a very healthy person, but she clearly was developing more respiratory symptoms.
And again, just disease in the chest?
Yes, primarily disease in the chest.
What was her life situation?
So she is married. She has 3 children. She was an artist.
So she got tested, was found to have the translocation, then what?
Yes, and this was now in September of 2008. And as soon as we found that she had the translocation, she was started on the same trial as the first patient. So on the phase one, now the dose expansion cohort of the phase one study, and she was begun on October 1st. She, very similarly to the first patient, noted within, I think, 2 weeks, she noted that her breathing had improved.
And any side effects and toxicity?
You know, she's actually done remarkably well on it. She has had minimal nausea, queasiness. She has not had diarrhea. She has had some fatigue, but she feels like the fatigue can be handled very well if she exercises. So she's an exerciser. She does it every day, and she feels like that works really, really well for her. So I would say she's done remarkably well in terms of side effects.
And it's now been 15 months?
And now it's been 15 months.
She's still responding?
Yes. So she actually had her first set of scans at 7 weeks after starting on trial, and her scans showed a very dramatic response. And ultimately, her measurements came out to show a 70% reduction in tumor burden.
Is she your patient or somebody else's?
So she initially started as Dr. Lynch's, and then she became my patient.
I see. What's it been like to deal with her? And I guess a lot of these patients, I mean, in a way, you're right. From their point of view, I guess it's a lot like when they have an EGFR mutation, but you know, for those who can understand the, how recent this is, what does she think about what's going on?
I think everyone is pretty amazed at this because it seems like many people know about EGFR mutations. And when patients hear that they do not have an EGFR mutation, they know what that means in the sense that they won't have this option to have an EGFR-directed therapy. ALK is very new, though, and so a lot of patients don't know what that means. And we, you know, we don't have the track record that we do with Erisa and gefitinib and erlotinib. So I think it's a bit of an unknown. And I know when she went into this phase one trial, she was a bit uncertain. I mean, this is a phase one. She was still early days. She had no idea if this was really going to work, no matter how much we told her about the biology.
And what's been going on with her personally?
She's doing great. And she is 100% functional, doing everything she wants to do, living life to its fullest. She has a wonderful blog where she talks about how much she's appreciating this extra time.
When people like this patient ask you, what's the likelihood that this is going to, you know, stop working? What do you say?
You know, unfortunately, I do tell patients that we know that at some point there's a very good chance that the tumors will develop resistance to the targeted therapies. And we know that because of the EGFR story. And as you asked me earlier about resistance to this compound, the 1066 compound, we have seen it in some patients already.
What's the longest that someone's been on it or responded to it?
Actually, this patient has been on the longest. 15 to 16 months is the longest that we've seen so far.
Do we know anything about the mechanisms of resistance?
We don't. We don't. But we're looking into this because we have had several patients who had intrinsic resistance. That means they didn't respond at all. And then we've had several other patients who acquired resistance during their time on the trial. And we have looked. We've gone back to some of these patients. We've obtained some biopsies of the resistant tumors, and we're looking into the potential genetic mechanisms that underlie this.
Any thoughts about why you see either of these oncogene addictions more in non-smokers than smokers? You know, I've been asking that for the last 5 years, and the closest I've heard is, well, the carcinogens cause so much damage that you don't have one single hit. Is that your take?
That's potentially an explanation. I do think there's good evidence that the lung cancers that we see in non-smokers are simpler cancers. And part of that's because they haven't been exposed to many of the types of carcinogens that smokers may have been. And so for them, they acquire one sort of critical hit in an oncogene, and that's all they need to then develop full-blown cancer. Many patients ask me about risk factors. You know, they've never smoked. Why did I get this? What are the risk factors? We don't know yet. One of the interesting things about ALK compared to EGFR, which we haven't talked about yet, is that in our study and actually in one of the Asian studies, we've shown that patients who have ALK translocations actually are about 10, maybe even 15 years younger than other lung cancer patients. That means those with EGFR mutations as well as those without. And so it does tend to be a younger cohort of non-smoking patients where we're identifying ALK.
Any sense about what fraction of lung cancer, what fraction of non-smoking lung cancer, and what fraction of other cancers might fit this oncogene addiction model?
So I think I would say the oncogene addicted models that we know the best now are EGFR. That's occurring in about 40 to 50% of the NUVR smokers. Now I would say that ALK also qualifies as an oncogene addicted cancer occurring in about 10 to 15% of the NUVR smokers with lung cancer. And then there are a handful of others that are probably less frequent, you know, more in the 1 to 5% range, such as BRAF mutations, HER2 mutations, and PIK3CA mutations. So there's a sort of alphabet soup of other mutations that can occur in non-small cell lung cancer that probably also confer oncogene addiction. And we're just testing some of those inhibitors in trials now.
Any sense, kind of looking over the fence there, at other solid tumors in terms of, you know, colon cancer, breast cancer, the common tumors? You know, of course, you don't have the smoking issue there, but any guess if we could really look at all these tumors, what fraction it might turn out to be oncogene addiction?
I think it's hard to know because we don't know fully all of the different mutations that can occur. And I think it's fair to say that in different disease types, these mutations could act differently. We do know that EML4 ALK translocations can occur in other disease types, in colorectal, for example, but at very low frequency. And I think because it's such a low frequency, it's really hard to find those patients and then to know for certain what the true frequency is.
You mentioned BRAF, and I was mentioning Keith Flaherty. I guess he's moved up to your neck of the woods, right?
He is, yeah.
With the melanoma and the BRAF. Have there been any lung cancer patients with his? It's a BRAF inhibitor, right?
It is a BRAF inhibitor, yes.
Has he actually treated any lung cancer patients with that new agent?
So I just saw him the other day, and I didn't get a chance to ask him about treating lung cancer patients. We very much want to get that inhibitor into clinical trials for lung patients. So we have not yet done that. We have been treating some of our BRAF mutant lung cancer patients with a MEK inhibitor. That's, you know, BRAF mutant tumors are believed to be more dependent on that whole signaling pathway, the RAS-RAF-MEK pathway. But we would much prefer to try that inhibitor that was used quite successfully in the melanoma patients.
What's the status right now of clinical research, let's say on this agent? Is it going into phase two, phase three? What's happening?
So actually the third case kind of gets to that, but I'll tell you that the phase one is now officially closed to patients who have ALK translocations in lung cancer. They're still investigating the efficacy of that drug in MET amplified tumors. We've moved 1066 now into a phase three trial that is actually for metastatic non-small cell lung cancer patients in the second line setting who have proven ALK translocations, and those patients will be randomized to receive either 1066 or standard chemotherapy, which on this trial would be pemetrexed or docetaxel.
So it's sort of an IPASS type 2 thing?
It is, except for IPASS, they didn't genotype initially, whereas right. For this trial, we're requiring proof of ALK positivity.
Well, also, IPASS was first line, and this is
and
second
IPASS
line.
And IPASS was first line, that's exactly
right. Kind of seems like, why didn't you just go to first line?
So there is a first-line trial that's being planned.
Oh, that's being planned.
Yes.
Okay. That's interesting. And, you know, another issue is a doc in practice is hearing this, and they're hearing it on whatever, TV now and USA Today. I mean, it seems like it really is getting out there. I'm sure mm-hmm. patients are asking about this all mm-hmm. the time.
Yes.
What does a doc in practice do to get his patient tested and maybe on one of these studies?
Sure. So the situation is different now, I would say, even as of this month compared to before. Right now, actually, the phase three study is opening around the country at about 60 or 65 sites around the country. It'll also open internationally as well. So there are actually many sites around the country that are going to be offering this phase three trial. And as part of that phase three trial, there is a screening for EML4-ALK. So patients now can actually have their tumors screened. It will be submitted through their local institution to a central lab.
You know, it reminds me a little bit about, we're talking about Joyce O'Shaughnessy, you know, their PARP inhibitor, BSI-201, and, you know, particularly say somebody with a triple negative tumor and breast cancer doesn't have that many options, and people are now thinking about trying to get on that study, not just to help research, but to help their own patients. One of the key things about that study that's so attractive is they cross over if they don't get randomized to the agent. How about in this one?
So for patients who are randomized to receive standard chemotherapy and progress, they will come off of the phase three study, but they will then automatically be eligible for a phase two study. It's a phase two companion study that is for patients who progress on the standard arm of the phase three, or for patients who are beyond second line and weren't even eligible for the phase three.
You know, another thing I was just thinking about kind of from a public health point of view, when you talk about 3 or 4% of non-small cell, it sounds like not that impressive, but I guess you're talking about what, maybe 5,000 people a year?
Yes, in the United States alone, that would still work out to 5 or even 6,000 patients a year, more than CML.
CML, yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow, interesting. Mm-hmm. So, and obviously a lethal disease. I just noticed that this case three that you're about to talk about is 22 years old.
Yes.
Wow. What happened there?
So this is a patient who actually presented when he was 21 and he had shortness of breath, primarily shortness of breath. He's a college student and he underwent a workup, which actually eventually revealed a lung mass and a malignant pleural effusion. His staging scans also showed sub-centimeter brain metastases. So he was clearly a stage four. He underwent testing immediately. So he comes a little bit later than the other two cases. We met him early in 2009. So when we first met him, he underwent a full panel of genetic testing. His EGFR and KRAS were wild type, but his ALK was positive. He underwent SRS right away for his brain lesions and then underwent cis-pemetrexed as his initial line of chemotherapy.
What was his life situation? In addition to being a college student, were his parents involved?
Parents were very, very much involved.
Wow. I'm trying to even grasp a 21.
It was a very tough.
This is your patient?
Yes. So initially, again, same situation. Dr. Lynch met him initially, and then Dr. Lynch transferred over to Yale himself. And so at that point, I met the patient. It was a couple of months into his treatment.
So then what was the next step in his case?
So he underwent chemotherapy with cisplatin and pemetrexed, did very, very well. Nice response.
And also, I see he got Bev too?
So he did, but then pulmonary embolus was detected on one of his restaging scans, and he was treated with low molecular weight heparin. So at that point, we actually discontinued the bevacizumab.
But he was asymptomatic from the PE?
Yes. Yes, it was an incidental finding.
How did he do in the chemo, Beth?
He did great, actually. He held up incredibly well, didn't have very many side effects despite getting a cisplatin-based regimen. He completed 6 cycles, nice response, and then he went on to maintenance therapy.
And then what?
So he's still on maintenance therapy. He's receiving pemetrexed, actually, as his maintenance therapy. He's back in college in Colorado, so he's under now the care of Dr. Kamage, who's also been working very hard on this phase 1 and now phase 3 study of 1066. And he's doing well. And the nice thing is that he and his parents both know that when his tumor progresses, he's going to have a good option, a good backup option.
You know, in breast cancer, somebody gets any piece of tumor out, and they're going to get an ER in HER2 100% of the time. When do you think we're going to get there with lung cancer in terms of not just EGFR mutations, but this fusion?
Right. So we're already there, at least at our institution. All lung adenocarcinomas are actually routinely screened for a panel of mutations and ALK translocation. We actually screen for 110 mutations involving 13 genes. Those include EGFR, KRAS, PI3 kinase, BRAF, and a handful of others. And then we also screen all lung adenocarcinomas for ALK translocations. Obviously, not every center is able to do that. We're doing it because we believe that the genetics really is such a powerful way of predicting response to therapies, and it really does open up doors for patients who otherwise might not have very many good options.
Can slides be sent to you all? Will you do the same screening, and how does that work financially?
Yeah, so it's still being worked out. And I would say up until the central lab, as part of this phase 3 study, was up and running, we were accepting slides to do ALK testing on from outside institutions. We're no longer doing that because now the central lab is doing that. In terms of the panel that I mentioned of the 110 mutations, that's a very complicated assay, as you can imagine. So we're actually not able to offer that as a send out. So we can't just accept slides for that. Patients who come to MGH, who are treated at MGH, or come for a second opinion are able to have that testing performed.
Any other place in the country that you can get this ALK fusion assessed, and is it reliable?
Yes. I mean, I think right now the gold standard for assessing for ALK translocation is via FISH. There are movements toward using IHC to look for the presence of an ALK fusion. But right now the gold standard really is ALK FISH. And like I said, the most important way of now in terms of accessing that test is just via any institution that has the phase 3 or is about to open the phase 3 study, because they will have access then to the central lab.
Now, would you say that patients with EGFR mutations tend to respond better to chemo?
I would. I think there is literature out there that definitely supports that EGFR mutation alone is a positive prognostic factor and confers an improvement in response even to standard chemotherapy.
So does that also apply to EML-ALK?
You know, I would have to say no, and we've looked pretty carefully at this in our patients. We have not seen an improvement in terms of response to standard chemotherapy. And here I'm talking about platinum combinations. And we recently completed an analysis that will hopefully present at ASCO this year showing that ALK by itself does not appear to be a positive prognostic factor.